Hi, this is Eugenio Duarte. I hope you enjoy the interview you're about to listen to. If you do, or if you have ideas for books you'd like to hear about on the show, let me know. Go to my website, EugenioDuartePhD.com, and click on Contact to send me a message. And now on with the interview. Hello, everybody. This is Eugenio Duarte in New York, your host for New Books in Psychology. And today, my guest is Patricia Gerovici, the author of the recently published book, Transgender Psychoanalysis, A Lacanian Perspective on Sexual Difference. And I'd like to introduce my guest. Patricia Gerovici is a psychoanalyst and analytic supervisor. She's co-founder and director of the Philadelphia Lacan Group, an associate faculty psychoanalytic studies minor at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also an honorary member at IPTAR, the Institute for Psychoanalytic Training and Research in New York City, and a member at APRECU, Psychoanalytic Association in New York. Her prior books include The Puerto Rican Syndrome, as well as Please Select Your Gender, From the Invention of Hysteria to the Democratizing of Transgenderism. And she's also published two edited collections, both with Manya Steinkohler, entitled Lacan on Madness, Madness Yes You Can't, and Lacan, Psychoanalysis and Comedy. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you, Kenya. Thank you for this kind introduction. I'm very happy to have the opportunity to have this conversation with you.
And I'm really happy to be able to talk to you. One of the things that I want to know first is how did you get involved in working with transgender people?
It has to do with the wonderful opportunity we are granted as clinicians. I always say that in the office, I happen to have a couch because I work as a psychoanalyst. And for me, that couch works like a window. And through that window, like a passenger on a train, we can see what's happening outside. And we see it in motion at times. At times, it comes to a stop and we can have a better look. But it gives us a very privileged viewpoint onto what's happening outside in society. And I find myself often surprised by seeing through this window things about which I will read in the newspaper maybe 3-5 years later. And that's how I encounter what I call the transgender democratizing, the democratizing of the transgender experience, which is brought to me by what the patients talk on the couch, by the window.
So how did you just by chance find yourself seeing a lot of patients who identified as transgender? Is this something that you've actively decided to pursue and become interested in and make a focus of your work?
I happen to have two types of patients, I may say. I had patients who identify as trans, but I also happen to have patients who were not identifying as trans, but were bringing questions about sexual identity. They happen to be posing questions. They were mostly identify as what we may call today cis. This means people who identify with the gender they were assigned at birth, mostly identifying as women, who were presenting questions about sexual identity. And they were asking, am I straight or bisexual? Mm. And I was wondering about this question. What was it expressing? They were mostly college-educated patients in this case. And I was wondering if this kind of a questioning was perhaps influenced by reading certain type of feminist, post-feminist literature, perhaps the works of the philosopher Judith Butler, who questioned the idea of gender as a given. And I contrasted this experience of people who question their gender, and that question brought them a lot of suffering, with people whose suffering was centered about an answer about gender. They knew, for instance, that they identify from a very early age, let's say somebody who was assigned as female may have felt like a boy, and knew that they identify as a boy besides being identify as society, as female, and for them the suffering was caused by the certainty of the answer. And I've contrasted these two very different experiences, and that led me to read more and explore more the issue about what did the transgender experience could teach us in general about what we may call widely gender trouble.
I feel like before we go further, I want to define transgender. What exactly does that word mean?
Often, transgender is a word that is used as an umbrella definition. Some people prefer to cut it and just say trans. It's often a word that people use to describe when they don't feel that they identify with the gender they were assigned at birth, that there is at times a discrepancy between what we may call a biological reality, sex, and their inner sense of gender. But what the clinic have taught me is that it's much more complicated than that and very illuminated for clinical issues. That's one of the interesting discoveries that the clinic had taught me, because I believe that in the patients and working with analytically oriented and alerted ears allows you to learn and discover many things. And this is one of the things I learned through working with patients who identify as trans, who may open a sort of certainty that for some people, a gender could be something they don't question. They fill out a questionnaire without any hesitation, or they may use a public restroom without thinking twice about which door to choose. Those people who may have some trouble with these issues can have the potential to teach us very interesting things and very helpful things for the clinical practice that are somehow universal. Yes.
No, I want to hear more about that. What you think that the transgender experience can teach all of us about gender and about sex?
That in a way, say the idea that the gender trouble of transgender identified people is in a way not specific to the transgender experience, but it's a general trouble that in order to assume a gender, to say, am I a man, I am a woman, or anything else in between, or none of the above altogether, implies a process of embodiment, that we need to assume a gender position, that we, even before we are born, when people may know they're pregnant and may have a sonogram to determine the gender of the child yet to be born, that it is a process that implies a lot of psychic elaboration and many stages in assuming a body. And at times, assuming a body with a specific gender may not correspond to what society assigns. And for instance, we could contrast the experience of transgender individuals with that of people who today we call intersex, and in the past we would call hermaphrodite, whose physical structure, the anatomical structures, cannot clearly determine whether or not we can call this baby male or female. We can see how society, and this is one of the interesting things that a philosopher like Judith Butler has taught us, and also from biology, that recent studies in medical anatomy and biology has taught us, and all the research done in intersex is like Anne Fausto Sterling could be one example of these the revelations that, in fact, to talk about two genders, this binary, is an oversimplification, mm-hmm. that we should at least talk about five genders, and that what we need to keep in mind is that whenever we talk about the gender, it's not such a simple thing that what for people who are maybe not giving a second of thought to, when I was mentioning before, a choice of a public restroom, the experience of those who may pause and have to make a decision says something about the long, complex process of embodiment that could challenge any sort of essentialism in believing that there is this an anatomic destiny. That, yes.
Well, I think then that one of the things that you're, tell me if this sounds like a fair reading of your ideas in your book, but it sounds like what you're doing is sort of turning our notions of let's say normative gender presentations and of transgender people and sort of inverting our ideas about them, because it sounds to me like what you might be suggesting is that the transgender experience teaches us that those of us who identify with our biological sex and proceed through life without much gender troubles, quote unquote, are actually that taken for granted process is a lot more complex than it seems, and that perhaps there might even be, I don't know if you would go so far as agreeing with this, but there might actually be something kind of unnatural and forced about the way that we do conventional gender, the way that we sort of force ourselves to choose a certain gender and a certain sexual object. Am I going too far in interpreting your ideas?
I agree absolutely with what you're saying. That's something that Sigmund Freud noticed, that why is it that he noticed that the first assumption we make upon running on the street, we see a stranger on the street, that the first thing we try to discriminate is male or female. Why do we need to do that? Because in another text, elsewhere in his works, he mentions that if someone from a different planet was to land on Earth and take a look, he would wonder, why do we make such a big deal about differences that are not so marked, that in a way between male and female the differences are not as measures as society constructs them. And that's what also the work of Judy Butler or Anne Fausto Sterling had taught us is today we know, after all the contributions of the feminism of the 60s, 70s, that gender is a social construction, but sex as a biological truth is also socially constructed. What we call male and female are social cultural constructions, and this idea that object choice or gender identification is a destiny that is marked one-way highway is an illusion. And I think this is one of the many important lessons that one discovers in the clinical practice working with patients identifying as trans, that they open up the possibility of challenging what you were calling fake normativity, that what we call normal is just a convention, it's a construction, and it changes with time, like fashions in society, in education, what is a sort of expected behavior rather than a truth. Yes.
Well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned Judith Butler, because throughout the book, I noticed her influence on your thinking. You use the term gender trouble quite a lot in the book, so I picked up on that influence. And I remember in Gender Trouble, she as well questions the idea that sex is biologically determined as well. Sex is a construction.
Yes, that even what we believe is to say the truth of the body, this immutable strata, is not. Right. It's that this is something that is also a construction. And that's what, for instance, from the medical field we learn, if we take a look at the research done on intersex, that at times are social conventions imposed on the flesh. And this is what one possible definition of embodiment, that when anybody who assumes a gender position and says, I am female or I am male or anything else in between, or I'm neither, I don't identify with the binary, all these options are social conventions. And maybe one indication we could find in the social media is, for instance, with Facebook, that has an enormous amount of worldwide uses in the billions, that for American users, you have 57 options for gender identification. Mm-hmm. So that indicates, and in the United Kingdom is over 70. So you could see that what we may call a binary is in the practice, at least for social media users, that is most of us, is obviously no longer as simple as we thought it to be.
Right. So then you know, you've written about gender before, and the such as with your book, Please Select Your Gender. So I'm curious about this book. You title it Transgender Psychoanalysis. What are you saying with that title, and what is the overarching thesis of this book?
What I discovered myself is when I wrote Please Select Your Gender, I published that book in 2010. I didn't know then I was going to ride a sort of wave in popular culture, a sort of a tsunami that was going to sweep away the clinical practice, and that it was going to force psychoanalysis to catch up. Mm. Psychoanalysis has a very bad history of normativization, at least in its most classical impersonation. That psychoanalysis has had a lot of, quote again, Judy Butler, gender trouble. But mm-hmm. maybe if we focus on the idea of trouble, in philosophy, a problem, a trouble, is often the beginning of thinking. It's an opportunity to rethink a problem and come up with hypothetical solutions or practical solutions. So in a way, what we see with this tsunami that had captured the popular imagination, not a day passes, and this has been, in a way, a challenge for me while I was writing Transgender Psychoanalysis. I would have my coffee for breakfast, open the New York Times, and there I would find every single day one piece of news relating to something connected with the trans experience. Yeah. That gave me the impression I was never going to be able to complete the book. I would never catch up. But I think this is important, that culture is trying to catch up with something that in a way is exceeding our intention to capture. Mm-hmm. And I think when I use the title Transgender Psychoanalysis, is because I think that the transgender experience, it teaches something about sexuality, that sexuality for human beings, for speaking beings, is trouble and is something that we have to come to terms with, and something that is it requires some psychic elaboration, some effort. And I think one example of that is that, for instance, animals don't seem to have trouble with sex or sexuality. And in a clinical practice, all we hear about is sex trouble, is either too much, not enough, is too soon or not soon enough. Or we always hear about this discrepancy, this in that there is something missing that we don't know of. And I think one evidence of that is, why do we need to have a sex ed about something that, if instinct will rule sexuality, why would we need to be taught what we should know already?
Why do you think that is?
Because sexuality for speaking beings implies what we were talking before, this process of embodiment, that there is a sort of psychic process, and the transgender experience is a long process of dealing, coming to terms, losses, mournings, gains, and there is this sort of long process. If you look at the all the writing, all the transgender memoirs, all these testimonies of gender reassignment or gender confirmation, often the metaphors that are used are about trouble, journey. Mm-hmm. That I think we should capture that there is, that assuming a sex body implies a long travel with at times a lot of luggage, and with many passing many frontiers, at times needing certain documentations to cross a boundary, at times not being able to pass that boundary. And I think all these metaphors of traveling illustrate this difficulty, that it implies passing a series of obstacles and implies a sort of a journey and a travesty, that we need to go from A to B. It's not a given.
So I agree with you that culture's always trying to keep up with what's going on with the transgender experience. But are you saying that psychoanalysis is particularly behind?
Absolutely. And I think it's it's about time to catch up. That's why I challenged psychoanalysis by choosing this title, transgender psychoanalysis, because I think that on the other hand, and that was one thing that I discovered doing research for the book, is that the history of psychoanalysis and the history of transgenderism, if you choose that word, are very linked. In the very early days of psychoanalysis, pioneers in what would become the clinic of the clinical practice of gender reassignment were extremely linked. They were collaborating, and evidence of that is that the first, one of the first psychoanalytic associations, ladies. Hello.
Oh yes.
In the background, yeah.
I can hear you now. We had a little. We have a little bit of static.
Okay. So I was saying that looking at the history of psychoanalysis, one of the first psychoanalytic groups, the Berlin Psychoanalytic Society, had six members, or like five or six people together, was Hirschfeld, who was a pioneer in sexology, gender practices.
Patricia, sorry to interrupt you again.
We need maybe to call back and.
Before we do that, is there any chance that maybe your microphone has moved?
No.
Oh, now I think I can hear you a little bit better.
Okay. Yeah, now it seems better.
Yeah, now it seems better.
Okay, good.
If you won't, just proceed and we'll cut this out later.
Okay, very good. So we see from the very early days of psychoanalysis a close connection and interrelatedness between the emerging field of psychoanalysis and the then emerging field of sexology, sex reassignment, gay activism, and I'm referring here to the beginning of the 20th century in Berlin, when the Psychoanalytic Berlin Society was founded. There was only five members. One of them was Max Hirschfeld, who was a pioneer gay rights activist and very influential figure, who was warmly welcomed by Freud. He was one of the founders of that society. And Freud thought from the very early days of psychoanalysis that a collaboration with the then emerging transgender field was important for the development and well-being of psychoanalysis. And unhappily, that didn't last too long, even though Hirschfeld was welcomed by Freud and he was a guest of honor in the first international psychoanalytic meeting. He soon left the society because he confronted what unhappily turned to be the reality of the psychoanalytic institutions for many years, which is the objection to his open homosexuality, and which was something that Freud felt it was important that psychoanalysis needed to side with that kind of political activism, that the future of psychoanalysis depended on that. So when I say transgender psychoanalysis is going back to this complex history and maybe go back to this protected collaboration that was cut short in the early days of psychoanalysis, but much needed today.
Yeah, you address that in the book, this ignored but important link between sexology and psychoanalysis. What in particular do you think psychoanalysis needs to learn from sexology?
It needs to learn that sexuality is not a given. For many years, if we think, say, between the 20s and maybe until the 80s, 90s, for instance, I think it was a sort of distortion that if you read texts like even Freud's early text on sexuality, his three essays on the theory of sexuality that owes a lot to what was then the emerging field of sexology. He quotes widely the sexologists of his time. That, on the other hand, practitioners thought that, for instance, homosexuality was a sign of abnormality. When Freud says that to make an homosexual or heterosexual object choice is equally contingent, and they are both equally problematic and equally unaccountable, that psychoanalysis still needs to figure out why do we choose to feel attracted to somebody maybe of the same gender or the other. And I think the contribution of sexology today and of the transgender studies today is that what we call male and female is also something that needs to be questioned and open up for discussion and could allow us to be better practitioners. I think psychoanalysis has a lot to offer in terms of easing psychic suffering and in that sense could help somebody who may identify as transgender in the same way that somebody who may identify as transgender could help psychoanalysis at the clinical level, at the theoretical level, in challenging these forced normativities and something I have been arguing since my previous book, Please Select Your Gender, is that I disagree with the pathologization of the transgender experience. I think there are ways of being. Somebody may identify as transgender as a way of being in the world, as the same way that somebody may identify as cisgender or may identify as agender, as ways, different ways of being in the world. They are not necessarily a sign of pathology.
But, you know, as a psychoanalyst myself, I observe the same thing you are talking about in your book and now, which is that we do have a history of pathologizing certain human experiences. And I struggle to understand why we do that, given that our whole mission is to embrace all the complexities and uncertainties of human experience. Do you have any clues as to why psychoanalysts have a tendency to pathologize transsexual experience?
I think it's an unhappy distortion of, I think, individual prejudice. Maybe I could even dare to say that those analysts may have not gone far enough in their own personal analysis if they can hold on to such unsustainable prejudice, and that in a way they are a victim of their own limitations because they may make them deaf in the practice, that they may stop hearing, as you're saying, as a clinician, the complexity of the human experience, the complexity of psychic formations, the complexity of metapsychology, that by assuming that one way of being in the world is without listening to the specific a sign of pathology. I was using the example of homosexuality that for many years, for classical psychoanalysis at least, was considered as a sign of pathology. That has been rectified. And I think that still that prejudice has moved on maybe now to those who identify as transgender. And hopefully the same evolution will take place. And this is what I'm arguing for and I'm trying to talk about, and that's why, again, the title Transgender Psychoanalysis, that there is that psychoanalysis needs to transition from this silly, I think, limiting and in a way anti-psychoanalytic position of prejudice onto a more ethical, clinically sound position that in the same way that I think the fundamental rule, and I think it's important that Freud calls it a fundamental rule, which is say whatever comes to mind without censoring yourself, without any prejudice, without thinking that is inconvenient or silly or offensive. This is how psychoanalysis should work, that in a way frame that fundamental rule of analytic neutrality also should force the practitioners to abstain from limiting prejudice and listen to the unique and very enlightening individual experience of each analyst, an analyst in particular. I think what is very rich in the psychoanalytic practice is that we work case by case. Each one each case is an opportunity for discovery and an opportunity for surprise, in a way, what the analysis will produce in each analysis will be a surprise for us and will be illuminating, and it will be a moment of creativity. And I think we should allow for that to happen by abstaining from any prejudice.
This might be a good moment to bring into the conversation Jacques Lacan, who you seem to really hold as a role model for how to think about the transsexual experience from a psychoanalytic point of view. Just to start at the beginning, could you tell us who was Jacques Lacan, and what do you like about his way of thinking?
Jacques Lacan is a French psychoanalyst who we may say is today the biggest number of psychoanalysts practicing, if we look globally. Brazil, Argentina, France, Italy, the most practiced in terms of numbers in direction in psychoanalytic practices, an orientation that allow us maybe to strip off the prejudice we were talking about, because one of the many contributions that Lacan brings is to think of the unconscious as like a language. Doesn't mean that it is language, but it is like a language, and in that sense is something shared and that everyone is part of. We are all speaking being, we are spoken about before we are even born, when parents may be thinking about the name for a child, and it's something that in a way would survive us, because even when we are no longer living, there would be a name that could bring us back to life. And in this sense, by thinking that the unconscious is this very individual thing, our peculiar, individual history, very contingent, very unique, and at the same time is social. And one of the other contributions of the what has been called in the American context the French Freud, he was a very close reader of the work of Freud, and what he brings back to psychoanalysis is a reading of Freud, of the most controversial Freud, we may see the most non-normative Freud, and he brings into the field of sexuality specifically the idea that to be male or female are just identifying with a certain word, identifying with a form of being in the world, with a positioning that does not necessarily need to do with an anatomical overdetermination. And in a way, like the trans experience, that liberates desire from essentialist and normatizing positions, that opens up implicitly new forms of desire that account for what the human experience is, which is very varied, like the 57 options in Facebook of gender identification. And also we are talking about gender identification, which is how do you go to bed as, rather than who do you go to bed with, which is a way of talking about object choice. And in that sense, we are also entering a field in which Lacan also gives contributions by expressing the contingency of object choices that have to do with several determinations that are as mobile and as changing, like a language is. A language is always changing, new words added to the language, and it's something that we can use creatively, but we don't fully own. Nobody can decide to add a word to the dictionary. It happens as a community effort, but affects each person individually. Yes.
Yeah, language then, I guess, really is a great metaphor, because language is also a man-made, a human creation. It's not something that comes from nature, but it's something that we've created. And I want to bring a particular attention to something you talk about in the book, which is a distinction that Lacan makes, and I think you alluded to this just now, you know, between the actual organs that we possess as humans and organs and the phallus sort of as symbols and metaphors. And it seems like if we think about it that way, then whether or not you have a penis, whether or not you have a vagina doesn't no longer really determines whether you're a boy or whether you're a girl. Am I reading his idea correctly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That is what we were talking before about this idea of embodiment. Already there, for instance, we're talking about language, the English use of the expression, I have a body. We are not bodies. We have them. Mm. Implies that there is something artificial in the sense that we're not longer talking about strictly nature as a given, but that if we have a body, we need to possess that body. We need to own it. And for some people may feel that they have the wrong body or that they need to modify that body. And I think we all modify our bodies. We are never fully operating with the body we have as a purely natural given. And this is something that somebody like Paul Preciado mentions, that at the time of the very televised and very public transition of Caitlyn Jenner, people could have been misled to believe that what Caitlyn Jenner was doing was artificially modifying the body as an exceptional activity. And this is not as exceptional as we may think.
Right.
Anyone who had gone to the dentist has maybe... a crown or an implant, or anybody who may have needed, I don't know, an implant or hip or knee replacement. So
who goes to the gym.
Exactly. Or absolutely. That we are always, even without the medical intervention, that's a good example, that even without depending on medical technology, we are intervening on the body culturally. And that's something that the cultural anthropologist like Marcel Mauss noted, like not all cultures swim the same way. We may imagine that swimming would be something universal. We see that the body is overdetermined by culture. And why not sexuality then? If we swim differently in different cultures, is the gait. People walk differently in different cultures. Why not assuming gender and choosing a partner may be different in different contexts, within different languages, within different cultural communities.
But if we take this idea as a guideline, this idea that anatomy is not destiny and that one's anatomy does not necessarily determine one's gender, does then that force us to rethink our ideas about individuals who nonetheless insist on transitioning medically and undergoing gender reassignment surgery in order to feel more themselves?
I think what is important in this idea of anatomy is not destiny, that teaches us something universal about how we relate to our beings, and our beings are sex, that I think the society we live in requires that we assume a sexual positioning. I was mentioning earlier on something that has been a controversy quite in the open eye, because it was on the front covers in the newspaper for many months, of the controversy about the use of public restrooms to satisfy the most basic need to go to the bathroom. We need, in the cultural space, in the social space, when we are in public, in a shopping mall or in an airport, we need to make a choice that is dependent upon a gender identification. I think what, on the other hand, is important to note is something that, in a way, surprised me as I was completing the book, is that I realized that, you know, I the book has in the title transgender psychoanalysis, and often initially when patients consult with what we call gender trouble, that in fact it was not about gender only. That in fact, like, it happens a lot with psychoanalysis, that somebody comes to see you, they call up, they make an appointment with supposedly a problem that brings them to work and start a psychoanalysis, but in fact the actual problem is not the problem that they were presenting.
Right, the presenting problem is just a ticket to admission in a way.
Exactly, and often gender is the ticket to admission, but the problem was, and that was for me a big revelation, was a problem of existence. When you're saying that somebody may need to undergo at times very painstaking physical modifications, at times difficult surgeries, hormone treatment, it may be as a strategy to be in the world. That the big discovery I was taught by my practice, and it was made clear with the writing of the book, is that it is about an issue of existence. There are questions of life and death, that patients would come and say, analysts would mention that if I would not have transition, I would be dead. Right. They would have committed suicide. So we're talking about life and death, the death decisions. So it's not so much an issue of gender only. The admission ticket is gender, but the true issue is about a way of being that otherwise they could not be in the world. And this is not a small issue that, right. For instance, if we look at the statistics, those identify as trans have a percentage of suicidal attempts of 41%. I will repeat because it's a shocking figure. 41% of those among the trans population have at least once tried to commit suicide. For the general population, the percentage is 4%.
Wow.
So see, it's exactly, wow. That's the wow factor. That why is this? And this is, I think, what is an indication that it's a way of finding a form of existence that makes life possible. And this was, I think, the new contribution of my most recent research, and this is what I developed in the book, that I discovered that it is more about life and death than about sex, gender, and sexuality.
It's so illuminating for you to discover that and share it with us. And it makes me think that, you know, as with so many other issues, sometimes the problem lives not inside of the person, but the problem sort of comes from outside. It comes from society. And you talk about in the book how it's society that makes us choose one sex or another as our object choice. It makes us choose to be one gender or the other. So if it's society that's freaking out about gender and sexual fluidity, shouldn't we be putting society on the couch rather than transgender individuals?
Yeah, that would be great if only we could. A very wide couch, and who would be the analyst would be the question for society. But indeed, I agree with you, and this is something identified early on by Freud when he wrote a text called Discontent in Culture or Civilization and its Discontents, that civilization, culture, society makes us very unhappy, very discontent, and it's a source of neurosis and pathology. But indeed, it's this back and forth that I think what psychoanalysis grants for the individual is a possibility to take distance from these social mandates, that it grants what Lacan calls a little bit of freedom, which is not so little if we think that allows you to move away and maybe separate from if society is freaking out, let society freak out, but maybe you find a way of existing a little at a distance from that. Now let that society pressure be not so crippling, not so lethal when we are talking about life and death. Let that discontent not kill you. And I'm not using it as a metaphor. I think unhappily it becomes a reality. People who may be thinking about taking their own lives, because life is impossible. And to make life possible, that's already a wonderful promise that psychoanalysis can grant. And on the other hand, we are seeing, and maybe I will take the liberty of feeling a little optimistic, we are seeing a change. Recently, the cover of Times Magazine, I think it was March of 2017, was talking about millennials embracing a gender identification.
Mm-hmm.
Much more open than their parents to those who identify as agender, queer, bigender, trans. So perhaps that discontent in society, what you call the freaking out, may not be as bad as may have been for previous generations. Let's hope that perhaps society can evolve. And that's one of the gambles, one interpretation of what I call the democratizing of transgenderism, the fact that we hear more and more in the public eye about the transgender experiences that could perhaps open the way to a more open, tolerating, and less freaking out society.
Well, I think you're right to be optimistic, and I will join you in the optimism. Patricia, we're almost out of time, and this has been such a enlivening and revitalizing conversation with you. Before we go, though, can you tell us what you're working on next?
What I'm working on next is several projects. One is an edited collection that is a spin-off from this first book I wrote in 2003 called The Puerto Rican Syndrome, which was a sort of testimony and reflection upon working as a clinician in the Philadelphia barrio, and not only seeing that psychoanalysis is possible with people who are often considered out of reach from psychoanalytic effects, maybe if we could put it bluntly, as I do in that book, is that the poor people can afford to have an unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
As a result of that book, then, I participated in a documentary called Psychoanalysis in El Barrio, and with Christopher Christian, we are putting together an edited collection called Psychoanalysis in the Barrios that gives testimony of a lot of clinical work, psychoanalytic clinical work, being done in what is considered, at least in the American context, as non-traditional venues for psychoanalytic practice. I'm also working on another edited collection on psychoanalysis, sex and gender, because I think that still psychoanalysis needs a lot of catch up, and
mm-hmm.
and we have contributors from many different areas, clinicians, academics, literary theory, because I think a lot of very interesting thinking is being done that needs to be known and read.
I'm glad you mentioned your interest in culture and race. For those of our listeners who don't know, I want to remind everyone about the documentary that Patricia is mentioning, Psychoanalysis in El Barrio. I've seen it. I hosted a panel where you talked about it, and it's really
yes.
a great film. I've seen it more than once, and I learn something each time that I watch it. And, you know, we didn't get to cover everything in the book, but again, the book is called Transgender Psychoanalysis, A Lacanian Perspective on Sexual Difference. And I really think anyone who's interested, not just in gender studies, but in cultural studies, really ought to pick this up. One of the things we didn't get to is your ideas on race and class and psychoanalysis.
Mm-hmm.
But anyone who cares about those issues should really be picking up this book. It's a great contribution to the literature. Patricia, I want to thank you for coming on the show. It's really been great.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for your very kind words about the book. I'm glad you enjoyed it, and I hope the audience might pick it up. And because I think it's important to question how we deal with difference. Could be gender difference, could be social difference, could be race difference, that unhappily we tend to segregate minorities by race, gender, class. And I think psychoanalysis, it could be a very good critical tool to question that, if it's faithful to what actually psychoanalysis, psychoanalytic theory proposes, and also what the clinic teaches,
mm-hmm.
that unhappily is not at times what has been distorted in certain interpretations of psychoanalysis. That if we go back to the essence of psychoanalytic practice, we have interesting tools to fight against discrimination, prejudice, and segregation, which still is creating discontent in society. And maybe to go back to the optimism we share about maybe a healthier society, a less unhappy one at least.
When your edited book on psychoanalysis in the Barrios comes out, will you come back on the show to continue our discussion on those ideas?
Oh, with great pleasure. I take it as an invitation. Thank you.
Definitely.
I'll be delighted.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Patricia. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Eugenio Duarte, your host for New Books in Psychology in New York. I hope that you enjoyed the interview that you just listened to. And I also hope that you'll keep letting me know who you would like to hear on the show next or what books in psychology you're reading. To let me know, go to my website, eugenioduartephd.com, and click on contact. Until next time, have a great week.